From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to it today. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, influential gay-hating Christian supremacist Scott Lively is the latest far-right fringe figure to benefit from the current anything-goes climate in conservative politics these days. A successful leader in exporting American-style anti-gay propaganda to Russia, Africa, and Eastern Europe, Lively, who of course claims the mantle of faith leader because why wouldn't he, gathered enough state convention support to appear on the GOP primary ballot for governor of Massachusetts. Despite widespread concerns from people of faith and secular human rights advocates, as well as military experts, about her involvement in a secret government torture program, the U.S. Senate voted this week to confirm Jenna Haspel as the first female director of the Central Intelligence Agency. And the month-long Muslim observance of Ramadan began Tuesday evening. Donald Trump marked the occasion by sending best wishes to all Muslims observing Ramadan. He further said, quote, "Ramadan reminds us of the riches Muslims add to the religious tapestry of American life. In the United States, we're all blessed to live under a constitution that fosters religious liberty and respects religious practice." Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
And now as we look back, we see how Israel has been that blessing to the entire world.
Islam is wrong. It is a heresy from the pit of hell.
Israel has blessed this world by pointing us to you, the one true God.
Mormonism is wrong. It is a heresy from the pit of hell.
Now we want to thank you, especially today, for the courageous leadership of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his determination to do whatever it takes to protect his people at all costs.
Yeah. Judaism, you know, you can't be saved being a Jew. Amen. Judaism won't do it. It's faith in Jesus Christ.
We thank you every day that you have given us a president who boldly stands on the right side of history, but more importantly, stands on the right side of you, oh God, when it comes to Israel.
Rather abruptly this week, the United States officially moved its embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, an action that diplomats and people of many faiths greeted with deep concern. Christian supremacist pastors were invited to pray over the ceremony. Meanwhile, theocratic white evangelicals gained yet more power in the U.S. administration. We'll look at all of this with Religion News Service's national reporter, Jack Jenkins.
Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon signed a bill that says private child placement agencies have the right to refuse to place children with adoptive and foster parents who violate their religious or moral convictions.
If you're feeling overwhelmed by the desecularization of federal policy and power, don't look for consolation at the state level. Bad things are happening in many parts of the country with far less media scrutiny. But it is inspiring that multi-faith activists are not yielding to the assaults, and we'll get one example from Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma President Rabbi Abby Jacobson. But first,
we are starting the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for a moral revival, not in commemoration of what happened 50 years ago, but launching a multi-year movement. It will be direct action, civil disobedience, power training, how to be a power, and voter mobilization.
For years after the death of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, 50 years to be exact. His prophetic message of social and economic justice for every American is being amplified in an unprecedented way by the faith-driven Poor People's Campaign. Rallies this past weekend across the country included arrests of religious leaders on Capitol Hill and elsewhere. But organizers say this is just the beginning of a 40-day campaign of moral action. With details, I'm joined now by the Reverend Liz Theo Harris, co-chair with the Reverend William Barber of the Poor People's Campaign. Reverend Theo Harris, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be with you.
The Poor People's Campaign has taken on a broad mantle of moral issues, so I'd like to begin with the areas of concern the campaign is focusing on.
Great. So we have identified five interlocking injustices that are inseparably linked and important for us to address together. And those are systemic racism. In particular, we're looking at voter suppression, we're looking at immigration, and we're looking at the mistreatment of indigenous communities. The next issue is systemic poverty. And in particular, we're looking at living wage jobs, the right to join and form unions, guaranteed income, housing, universal single-payer health care, equitable education. We're looking at the problems of ecological devastation, the pollution of our water, the havoc that climate change is wreaking on people all over the world and country, especially the most poor and marginalized, the impact of extreme extraction on, again, particularly poor and marginalized communities, but everyone. And then militarism and the war economy, how our nation spends 53 cents of every discretionary dollar on the military and only 15 cents on anti-poverty programs. And then we're looking at the connection between those four injustices and a distorted, immoral, heretical narrative of Christian and religious nationalism. In particular, a narrative that blames poor people for our problems, that pits people against each other, and that claims that there is scarcity when we're really living in a society of abundance. So these five interlocking issues of racism, poverty, ecological devastation, militarism and the war economy, and this distorted moral narrative are the focus of this campaign. And we, like Dr. King, believe that you can't get rid of one without getting rid of the other. And that in poor people, in marginalized people, they kind of sum up all these different issues that are plaguing our society.
In what ways is the situation today little changed from the days of Dr. King?
So today, in 2018, there are 140 million poor and low-income people. That is 43.5% of the country. And in fact, there has been a 60% increase in poverty since 1968 when Dr. King and others were working on the Poor People's Campaign. 60% more people are living in poverty today than 50 years ago. Today, 50 years past that Poor People's Campaign, past many of the gains of the civil rights movement, we have fewer voting rights. Today, we have way more money being spent on the military. We have this problem of ecological devastation. So we are living in a time of deep moral crisis, in a time when if we don't unite people around these different issues from all walks of life, from all races and religions, from all geographies, from all genders and sexualities, if we do not come together and come up with proactive solutions, demands like single-payer universal health care, demands like automatic registration at the age of 18, demands like equitable education for our kids, demands like really curbing the environmental impacts of extreme extraction. If we don't do what we are starting to do in this campaign, then this country is headed for absolute devastation is headed in the wrong direction. And so that's why we need to unite, why we need a Poor People's Campaign, and why we're calling for a national moral revival.
It's a difficult time. How do you look at that and say, what are we going to do?
So these are definitely difficult and dangerous times. I mean, right, this week, as we launch this massive, expansive wave of nonviolent civil disobedience and these 40 days of people, poor people, clergy, other activists coming together in more than 30 states in Washington, D.C., this major campaign to uplift the poor. As we launched, Congress was threatening to cut $7 billion from CHIP. We had moms testifying on the Capitol grounds, wailing like Rachel wailed for her children who were no more because of death, because their kids didn't have health care, because of death, because their kids were in poverty. This is in the richest nation in the world.
Yeah.
At a time that we have, you know, the productive capacity to end homelessness now, to end the lack of health care now, to end hunger now, right? I mean, this is a problem of will, not of resource. And as someone who has been organizing amongst poor and homeless people for 25 years now, what I have found traveling with Reverend Barber and others for the past bunch of years building this Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival, is that people have never been more ready to stand up, get together, and to organize, and to cry out and cry loud and have their voices heard, and then be able to put forward proactive solutions, demands that could end these conditions, and to start to have a national discussion in this country about the issues that affect so many of us, but that are overlooked and ignored, and to build power from below, from people in states across this country, and build a righteous social movement for change. And so these are really hard times, and we actually have to show this nation, put a mirror up to it and say, look at what is going on. How is it possible that there could be 140 million poor people, 38 million poor children? This is unjust. And it is also a time when people are willing to do what they've never been willing to do before, which is come together across all of these lines that are dividing. And so at the same time as I have great, you know, sadness for where we are, I have gotten great hope. It's not an idealistic hope, but it is a hope that people are standing up in communities and saying, we're ready. We're ready for change, and we're going to be that change.
Liz, how big a role does race play in marginalizing some of our fellow Americans today?
So we start in this campaign looking at the problem, the injustice of systemic racism, because there is no way that we can talk about really addressing economic injustice or environmental injustice or militarism and war without really seeing the role that systemic racism plays in helping to make all of those possible. So when we this week take on systemic racism as the main issue of our days of action, we will in particular pull out the issue of voter suppression and how racist gerrymandering and racist voter suppression has led to bringing about candidates in states that then pass legislation that hurts all people. And it, in some places, hurt more poor white people than even poor people of color. So we need to show people how racism marginalizes and isolates and hurts and kills, and we have to show how it impacts the very core of our democracy and the very soul of our nation.
This is a national campaign, obviously, but of course, events are happening in specific physical locations. Would you talk about the kinds of events that are still ahead in the coming weeks?
So, on Mondays, across the country, in more than 30 states and in Washington, D.C., people are taking action at their state capitals. And they're drawing attention to the different themes and issues that this campaign is highlighting. Like, this week we'll be focused on systemic racism. The following week we'll look at the war economy, militarism, and the proliferation of gun violence. And so in the states and in D.C. on Mondays, we'll be engaging in nonviolent civil disobedience and organizing and mobilizing and making sure that we hear as a nation the voices of impacted people. We also are doing other kinds of events throughout the 40 days. We do these mass meetings that we live stream. We're holding nationally broadcasted teach-ins because we want this country to learn about the reality that people are living in and to hear some of the proactive solutions and demands that are coming, you know, from people who have stood up and said, mm-hmm. we need to stand for justice. And we're doing CO musicology and movement cultural arts events. And we're spreading out lots of resources to faith communities and houses of worship to make sure that they bring their congregants and others along in terms of studying the issues and finding ways to get involved in a budding moral movement. And so we are doing those over the course of the next 40 days. We will have even more activities and actions happening the last week here in Washington, D.C., where we'll be setting up an encampment where we'll be doing more activities and actions. And then there will be a mass mobilization in Washington, D.C. on June 23rd that will be really kind of like a next steps gathering where folks will be inspired to go back to their states and keep building for the long haul. And so, you know, there's a lot of activity taking place. And again, historians have told us that what happened on Monday and what people are planning for over the next 40 days is the most expansive wave of nonviolent civil disobedience in this country's history, because people are doing it at state capitals, they're doing it all across the country, they're coordinating, and they're committing to coming back and back and back.
Liz, tell our listeners across the country how they can get involved or how they can support this campaign, please.
So we need people to join. We need people to lend a hand and lend their voice and even decide that they want to participate in the nonviolent civil disobedience. And so people can go to poorpeoplescampaign.org and click on our interactive map there. Find out where actions and activities and trainings and gatherings are happening in your state and contact directly the leaders of those activities and actions and the coordinating committees in those states and get involved. If you also go to the website, you can just register and take the pledge to be involved. And we do need people to donate. We need people to pray. We need people to spread the word in social media and other kinds of media that there is something happening in this country. And it's that poor people and moral leaders are standing up and saying, somebody's been hurting our people, and it's gone on far too long, and we won't be silent anymore.
Reverend Dr. Liz Theo Harris is co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. Liz, I thank you so much for, in a busy time, taking time to talk with us, and know that you're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be with you, and thank you for sharing the word.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Stay with us. From Washington to Israel, we'll look at this week's breaking news in religion and in politics with journalist Jack Jenkins. And later, a defeat for adoption rights in Oklahoma because God. Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma President Abbe Jacobson will be with us. I'm Wilton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. From the Rose Garden to Jerusalem, there are political religious right dreams coming true. With the rest of us, religious and secular folks alike, look on in confusion and consternation. In attempting to take a rational view of these events, I am grateful to be joined now by Jack Jenkins, national reporter at Religion News Service, a friend of the show. Jack, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much for having me back.
Let's begin in Washington, D.C. Would you talk about the new White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative and the office that it replaces?
Just recently, the president signed an executive order that creates the White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative. Now, what is interesting about it is that it looks like it's replacing the White House Office of Faith-Based Initiatives and Neighborhood Partnerships that was created under the Bush administration and was continued under the Obama administration. Trump had actually been criticized, and his press secretary had been asked about the fact that he has not filled that slot with a new head of that White House Faith Office, among other parts of the religion initiatives that Obama created that he's dismantled. So, for instance, at the State Department, there used to be a very large team that dealt with religion that has been mostly destroyed and left with only a few staffers that have been folded under other parts of the State Department. Mm-hmm. But this new initiative, it's actually not clear to a lot of observers how this operates differently from the previous White House faith-based office. There's some who say that, you know, the way that it's written means that it might not have to go through as much scrutiny as previous faith offices in terms of how they set up an event. But generally speaking, it's designed to, you know, provide recommendations on the administration's policy agenda and provide recommendations on programs where faith-based and community organizations can partner on different issues. And again, this sounds a lot like what the old office is. So it's not entirely clear what this one is doing new.
Who has been praying for this to happen?
Well, you know, he signed this on the National Day of Prayer. And the elements of this seem to be a lot of optics, right? So there's the practical element of this office and what it will accomplish. And then there's the political element of President Trump continuing to appeal to the kinds of folks, like you said, you might be praying for this, who are mm-hmm. religious right figures. And in particular, white evangelicals writ large across the United States who have, as many have noted, both supported him during when he ran for office and have continued to support him after he has, you know, held the presidency. So in a lot of ways, this is an overture to that group.
Jed, is this office going to be under the supervision of the ambassador of international religious freedom?
I don't believe so. I'm not sure it's specifically under that supervision, since this is technically a White House office. Mm-hmm. Now, since you bring it up, you know, what is under, or at least works with, the Ambassador for Religious Freedom is the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, which just had a religious right figure appointed to it in Tony Perkins. To your point, what we're seeing here is it's not clear who's going to head up this office yet, this White mm-hmm. House office, but, you know, there's a lot of connections between these sorts of overtures and these government entities that have to deal with religion and, you know, really conservative Christian evangelical groups and their leaders. So in many ways, it's kind of the codification of their influence over this White House, whereas before it was kind of, you know, Trump has his evangelical executive advisory committee that is unofficial, that often advises him mm-hmm. on matters of faith and of religion. And now there seems to be his slow creation of official positions that these sorts of figures will occupy within his administration.
Jack, I never have thought of Tony Perkins as a big fan of religious freedom as described in the two religion clauses of the First Amendment. How can Perkins impact the work of this commission? Because I honestly have some fear of negative repercussions here.
So when he was appointed, when it was news broke that Tony Perkins had been given this appointment on the commission, a lot of groups, you know, rapidly issued press releases condemning it, particularly mm-hmm. LGBT rights groups. Mm-hmm. And they have long been frustrated and spoken out against Tony Perkins and his organization that he heads, the Family Research Council, which has been deemed to be an anti-LGBT hate group by the Southern Poverty Law Center. Mm-hmm. Now, the Family Research Council refutes that, but LGBT advocates argue that they refute the label of hate group. They don't necessarily refute all of the things that the Southern Poverty Law Center lists as evidence that they should be labeled as a hate group, mm-hmm. which is to say that when Tony Perkins talks about religious liberty, particularly for LGBTQ advocates, they see him talking about legislation that they argue is used to discriminate against LGBTQ people. So, you know, when we're talking about religious freedom, and there is a lot to this, in 2018, and really over the past few years, religious freedom has been interpreted as code for providing conservative Christians a way to remove themselves with, you know, having to, according to LGBT advocates, you know, give LGBTQ people the same rights as straight people, that mm-hmm. these sorts of laws are really geared towards protecting conservative Christians and their religious beliefs, not necessarily the religious beliefs of others. Because mm-hmm. as you well know, there are actually multiple religious traditions that sure. you know, not only ordain LGBTQ people, but allow ministers to officiate same-sex weddings. And most larger Christian groups in the United States, large religious groups, actually the majority of their parishioners support same-sex marriage and oppose these sorts of religious liberty laws that we're talking about. So one of the big concerns about Tony Perkins ending up on this commission is that he'll replicate, according to LGBTQ advocates, that kind of interpretation on a global scale, mm-hmm. right? So this commission doesn't have the kind of power to make laws in other places, but, you know, it can apply pressure, and mm-hmm. that's a concern that they have.
We need to take a look at the events in Jerusalem this week. It felt like this move of the U.S. Embassy was really sudden, although obviously there has been discussion about it for a while now. Were you surprised by the timing?
It is certainly true that Trump's confidants and the Trump administration, you know, had signaled that this was something they might want to do. Mm-hmm. But the timing did seem rather sudden, and that the timing itself actually is what frustrated a lot of groups, including Jewish groups. In mm-hmm. fact, the largest Jewish group in the United States, according to Pew Research, the Union for Reform Judaism, their head actually issued a statement after Trump announced that they were going to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel and then move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem, saying that while the Union for Reform Judaism technically supports this move eventually, the timing was not something that they could support. You know, a lot of Jews would prefer that it only occur after a, you know, lengthy negotiation process between Israel and Palestinians as a part of the peace process. And this just kind of seems to have forced the issue in a way that a lot of people didn't expect.
Mm-hmm. Jack, the preachers who spoke at the embassy opening, what message did the choice of these ministers send? And is it possible that this was the message this administration wanted to send?
Right. So, you know, you're referring to the two different pastors who bookended the ceremony, you know, commemorating the new U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem were Robert Jeffress, Texas pastor, and John Hagee. And those two individuals have, you know, in many ways made a career out of being very controversial. You know, Robert, one of the first people to speak out when it was announced that Jeffress would be praying at this embassy opening, it was none other than Mitt Romney,
yes.
who referred to him as a, quote, religious bigot. And what he is referencing is that Jeffress had referred to Mormonism as a heresy from the pit of hell. Jeffress was also referred to Catholicism as something that exposes the genius of Satan. He has said that Jews cannot be saved unless they convert. He's said really, you know, inflammatory things about Islam. And this is also the same guy who has been vehemently supportive of Donald Trump. When Trump attended the 4th of July celebration last year, it was Robert Jeffress who mm-hmm. brought his choir to that celebration and had them sing a hymn-like song, Make America Great Again. And Trump eventually actually ended up promoting Jeffress's book on his Twitter feed. So mm-hmm. there definitely seems to be both a mixture of Jeffress as this kind of volatile religious figure and a deep support that he has for Trump. Mm-hmm. And now on the other end, you have John Hagee, who has actually made a firm career out of associating himself with Israel. He runs an organization called Christians United for Israel that is arguably one of the largest, if not the largest, pro-Israel organization in the country. But he does that with some theology that many people find kind of fringe, which is what's called dispensationalism. He believes that things like Jerusalem being the capital of Israel are important for the second coming. He has made some controversial comments and writings about Jews, arguing that, you know, the sufferings that they endured were part of God's plan. So you have these two kind of really dramatic figures, and they're sending a very specific message about the Trump administration. And I imagine one is that, as mentioned, Robert Jeffress and Trump are cohorts in some ways, and so that there is some element of loyalty and affiliation here, but also that this specific brand of evangelical Christianity is the one that the White House decided to lift up when they're establishing an embassy. And that sends a very particular message, both to Jews in Israel, but also, you know, the wider planet that has long seen Jerusalem as this shared city in an international sense. And now the, you know, one of the most powerful nations in the world, the United States of America, their embassy there is inflected with this evangelical Christianity. And even then, a form of evangelical Christianity that a few years ago, a lot of people would probably argue is fringe. In Jerusalem in particular, for evangelicals, if you believe in dispensationalism, which is this kind of subset of theology, and there's many different versions, but a lot of them center around the idea that Jerusalem is very important biblically because you had the kings of old reign there and then Jesus there, and now someone like Donald Trump is, according to, you know, many of these evangelicals, literally fulfilling biblical prophecy. Mm-hmm. And so when this new embassy gets erected and when he declares Jerusalem the capital of Israel, this is in line with the kind of end times theology preached by people like John Hagee and Robert Jeffress.
Yeah.
And so it's not just an overture in a domestic sense where he's pleasing his base, although he is doing that. Mm-hmm. It's also, you know, for those that really buy into that theology, him making good on, according to them, a scriptural mandate.
Yeah. You know, it just feels like, to me, that a lot of the major decisions that are coming out of the White House are being made by a very specific, very small group of white evangelical apocalyptic Christians, while everyone else doesn't really get the context. Am I being too cynical about these things?
To be perfectly frank, I think a lot of political observers might have thought you were pretty cynical if you'd said that last year. And now, at this point, I think a lot of people have come around to the idea that it's still not exactly clear who holds, you know, sway in the White House and who can convince Trump to do anything. But as much as anybody has any particular brand of influence, white evangelicals seem to exact a disproportionate amount. For instance, Tony Perkins, again, the person who was recently appointed to the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, he is credited in several reports as being a driving force behind Trump's, you know, efforts to ban transgender people from the military. I mean, that's his precise policy outcome from the advocacy of him and his organization, according to those reports. So I do think that it's safe to say that if there's one group that seems to have disproportionate sway on the President of the United States right now, it does seem to be the religious right, and in particular, a very specific brand of the religious right that, again, a few years ago might have been dismissed as fringe, but in 2018 is helping set the policy of the country.
Given the religious literacy that is playing into these major decisions, we have to have people who understand what religious convictions are and how influential they are being used in this particular administration.
In my personal feeling, if you really want to understand what's happening in American politics right now, you have to have a good grasp of religion. I've said this before on your show. You know, I think religion, specifically Christian nationalism, is one of the most important ideologies in our political milieu right now. I think how that interacts with various religious groups is super important. And the only way to really understand a lot of the groups who are targeted by some policies like the travel ban is to also understand religion. I mean, for better or for worse, if you want to have a full grasp of where our country might be going politically, I think it's required that you have some sort of fluency in both religious beliefs and religious leaders, because it certainly seems to be how decisions are getting made in Washington. And whether or not even everybody in the White House understands all those things is an open question.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think newsrooms would be well served to take the time to understand the main players, both politically and theologically, in Washington these days.
Jack Jenkins is national reporter at Religion News Service. Jack previously covered religion for Think Progress, and his writing has appeared in numerous national publications. Jack, as always, it's great to have you on, and know that we want you to keep on doing what you're doing so well, and know that you're also welcome anytime on State of Belief Radio.
Well, I love being here. Thanks for having me.
In Oklahoma, a campaign to prevent enshrining overt anti-gay discrimination in a state law regarding adoption has failed. But giving up is not an option. And so I am grateful to be joined now by Rabbi Abby Jacobson, president of Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma. Abby, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
So, what's wrong with the bill that Governor Fallon signed into law?
Essentially, what has happened is that since we have not had enough public adoption and foster care agencies, some private agencies have stepped in. And as I think we know, many private adoption and foster agencies are religious in nature.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were filling a much-needed gap left by the publicly funded ones, the privately funded ones began to receive government funding. And once they received government funding, there became an expectation that they would act as public adoption agencies and foster care agencies, which means we assumed that anyone of any religion or any sexual orientation or family background would be allowed to foster and adopt through them, particularly adopt, as long as they were capable, loving parents.
Mm-hmm.
And with this bill that's recently been signed into law by Governor Fallon, that's just not true anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So agencies, even if they are receiving government funding, are now allowed to discriminate against potential parents on the basis of their religious identity or their sexual orientation.
How significant was faith-based rhetoric in pushing this discriminatory legislation in Oklahoma?
Well, that's a great question. Unfortunately, in Oklahoma, a lot of bills get done quietly. We understand that in the Oklahoma legislature, every bill gets heard between 3 and 5 minutes in committee before it's passed out, which means that most of the discourse on a particular bill is done without anybody in the public ever hearing about it.
Hmm.
So I would love to be able to paint a picture for the listeners of protests and religious people on both sides having shouting fights in the streets. But
mm-hmm.
actually what happened was this slipped in under the radar of almost everybody except for the legislative watchdogs at a couple of LGBTQ civil rights organizations and a couple of religious interfaith organizations
mm-hmm.
that picked up on this as it was getting to committee and said, we have to sound the alarm. As far as we know, there were 3 major petition campaigns that went to the governor, and one of them was from the interfaith community, and there were 2 major efforts in the LGBTQ community, as well as a couple of national religious organizations that sort of had their own email campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
We assume that the homogenous nature of the Oklahoma State Legislature led in great part to this effort.
Mm-hmm.
So we can only really sort of guess at where that energy was coming from, but we know that it went through with very little protest from other legislators, which was deeply upsetting to us, both in the interfaith community and in the pro-LGBTQ rights community.
Would you say this legislation was the state leadership doing good government or what they would call good religion?
If I understand the purpose of government to be to do the best for the people who are living in that area,
mm-hmm.
I can't see this as being the best.
Mm-hmm.
With so many kids in Oklahoma in the foster care system waiting to be adopted, and with so many of them not making it, we think right now there are about 4,300 children in the state of Oklahoma who are eligible to be adopted out of the foster care system right now. And many of them just aren't going to be. Hundreds of them just aren't going to be. I don't say that's good governance. I say that good governance gets those 300 children adopted, and it gets those 4,300 that are waiting to be adopted into loving families as quickly as possible, and this isn't it. So I have to assume that it is doing good religion rather than doing good government, but doesn't feel like good religion from where I'm sitting either.
Abby, there was an enormous faith-inspired coalition that came together around this legislation. Faith leaders across the state as well as national organizations signed on to a letter to the governor urging her to veto the bill. Is this a coalition that is ongoing and works together on other issues as well?
The Oklahoma community is a very strong community. This particular issue reached beyond the borders of what we normally think of as the rights, religion, culture, and civil rights groups that we normally work with. This even reached beyond that. I think it was such an important issue that it brought in people who were not normally our partners, which was wonderful to see that we're able to come together in times of adversity, and we're always trying to expand to make sure that everybody's at the table.
How receptive are Oklahoma citizens to the activism progressive people of faith are engaging in there?
Well, that sort of depends. We find that there is a pervasive, very gentle, very quiet fear of change and fear of an unknown other. It seems to be backed up by some of the rhetoric we're seeing nationally, you know, when people talk about the war on Christmas, so to speak, or a fear that allowing room for another point of view might take away something from their point of view. That's something we deal with a lot here. And so we find that many kinds of pro-diversity moves are not received well, and we have to be very careful with our messaging to make sure that we are not showing ourselves as hostile to what many consider to be the majority norm. I mean, there aren't that many people in Oklahoma, and there are many communities that seem from the outside to be fairly homogenous, and that does not breed a love of diversity. I have to believe that the people we work with and the people to whom we're trying to bring our message are genuinely good people who really care about their community, many of whom are people of faith. And I have to believe that they are trying their best to do what they believe to be true and right and good. And we are trying to work with our messaging to make sure that what we do sounds good in their ears the same way it sounds in our ears. And that means we have to walk very carefully to make sure we're not being threatening. But it's a big challenge for us.
Knowing that this is going to be an issue in other places as well soon, Rabbi, are there lessons that you think can be learned from what you've been through in Oklahoma that might be of benefit to people working on such an issue elsewhere?
I would say yes. The two lessons I would hope people would take away would be, please be very careful when considering inviting private groups to do the government's job, because there can be a big trade-off. And We've certainly seen that with the adoption system in Oklahoma. And the other one is, I think everybody's really focused on trying to live our regular lives, and sometimes major issues can slip by. And I really have to applaud the agencies in Oklahoma that picked up on it, mm-hmm. on this particular issue. Oh, also, the Oklahomans United for the Separation of Church and State, they mm-hmm. played a big part in pulling this together as well. Sure. I don't want to give them credit for mm-hmm. it. But I think that it is really easy to watch things go by out of committee, into committee, without really knowing what's going on. And I think this one sneaked up on a lot of us in a what in Oklahoma was a crowded rush to finish the legislative session as early as possible and get out of there. So please watch the legislation in local committee type settings mm-hmm. to make sure that that this isn't being, you know, thought of in a back hallway and pushed through at the end of the session.
If you will, Abby, give our listeners information on how they can keep up with what's going on the Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma, and so they can also support that if they wish.
Thank you. We have a website which can be found by looking for Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma or going to TIAOK, as in the Interfaith Alliance Oklahoma.org. To sign up to be on our email list, and also, of course, the National Interfaith Alliance website that does such a great job of trying to pick up on not only national issues but also local issues that are of import.
Abby Jacobson is president of Interfaith Alliance of Oklahoma, and she is the rabbi of Emmanuel Synagogue in Oklahoma City. Abby, it's a setback to be sure, but the coalition of faith-inspired activists that have come together around this issue in your state really is inspiring, and we have to keep our fingers crossed as a similar initiative comes before the legislature in South Carolina next week. You have been very helpful in talking about what went on there and what may be helpful to people in other places. It's always great to have you on. Thanks for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much. Thank you for bringing this issue to national attention.
Now, before we go, let me first quickly note that with the torrent of headlines and revelations concerning this administration only increasing this week, I found myself questioning the relevance and timeliness of the thoughts that I'm about to share with you. But even as breaking events can be incredibly important, there are fundamental principles that we absolutely must continue to hold close, and perhaps closer still when distractions are so abundant. Numerous presidents of the United States have spoken about the way in which the responsibilities and decisions of that high office repeatedly drove them to times of humility, prayer, and a search for divine strength. Now, President Trump is different. Whether or not he prays, I don't know. I am well aware of several times in which he has said that he had no need of divine forgiveness, a comment that makes me think, since forgiveness is a major part of personal prayer, he finds no need for prayer or divine guidance. Ironically, though, I have noted that when President Trump attends meetings convened for prayers, he has a tendency to announce decisions that run counter to our nation's Constitution and the proper way in which religion and government should interact. Take, for example, a week ago on the National Day of Prayer, when the juxtaposition of three acts of the president were as eye-opening and disturbing as was the substance of the acts themselves. On May 3rd, the president's day began with him acknowledging for the first time publicly his $130,000 payment to a porn star with whom he is alleged to have had an affair. He went from that stunning confession straight to the Rose Garden to deliver his speech at the National Day of Prayer. There, after a few generalizations about prayer, he lamented the failure of his campaign to destroy the Johnson Amendment, which, if passed, would have been one of the greatest negative blows to the unity and integrity of religion in our nation's history. Then, the president gave to the nation what he considered a gift and what most religious leaders and devotees of the Constitution considered a regressive move to weaken religious freedom. The president's new executive order, known as White House Faith and Opportunity Initiative, closed the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives. And let me stress, that step is one that I applaud. But then it created a new office that continued rather than replace the work of the older office that immediately compromised religious freedom even more. Viewed as a means of giving more money and power to evangelical Christians, the president's new initiative finances religions to offer government services with the freedom to practice discrimination without accountability or negative repercussions. The executive director of the Secular Coalition of America observed that the president's new initiative assured the religious right that the White House shared their agenda. Christianity Today observe that the new order will allow the faith community to partner with the government on issues like mental health, prison reform, education, and humanitarian causes, claiming that faith is more powerful than government. The president seemed to envision a government not based on a constitution, but on faith. And of course, a direct contradiction to the founding vision of this nation and the Constitution bequeathed to us by the founders of this nation. As President Trump removed religious freedom for many and assured religious freedom for a few, he called it a great day. Now, mind you, despite all of the talk about prayer and religion, the president offered no promise of an administration of moral integrity, only assurance of people's right to religious bigotry. Whether or not the president prays is not a matter of interest for me or for any good citizen. What is a crucial concern, though, is the president's irresponsible support for people who, in the name of religion, are eroding our Constitution and weakening the democracy bequeathed to us. Whether praying spiritually or simply behaving as a good citizen, I urge the president to remember where he is, where he sits in our government, the promise he made to defend the Constitution, and begin to demonstrate a resolve aimed at strengthening our nation rather than selfishly and egotistically, with no moral authority whatsoever, seeking to build a religion and a government in which he can be the supreme leader of both. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, thank you, thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going on.